Good morning, church. This was obviously for somebody taller than me, which isn't saying much. Well, first off, I guess, greetings from Thomas. I talked to him last night, and he said, tell the Northern Hills Church hi. So, hi from Thomas. That's just getting kind of weird, isn't it, already? Are you sleepy? Do you need to stand up and stretch or anything? I know you lost an hour. Sabrina said, you better preach good because I'm sleepy. So, while we were working in Spearfish, we had a supporting church in Post, Texas, and they flew their elders up, some of them anyway, every year to encourage us. Thank God. They were a wonderful bunch of people. They had a young rancher who owned a nice twin-engine King Air plane, and they would often fly in his aircraft. And on one of those trips, he offered to give us a ride over the Black Hills, which, if you'll notice, when you're flying commercially, you don't typically fly over the hills because there's a lot of ups and downs. And I was pretty stoked about the idea of flying over the hills. So a bunch of us got on board the plane and we flew over the hills. And it was indeed a rather turbulent ride. And I got to sit in the cockpit, which was really cool. I think that was the first time I've ever been in the cockpit of an airplane, but we came in for a landing. It was a very bumpy landing. And Jeff, the pilot, after we got on the ground, he took his headset off and he looked over at me and he said, we cheated death one more time. So, Alan, happy birthday, man. You cheated death one more time. I really struggled with what to preach. In fact, I tried to take the easy way out. And so, do we end at noon or? Because I'm ish. Well, no, you don't dare say that. That's like yelling "sick 'em" to a bulldog. That's. I really struggle with what to preach. I thought, well, if this is the only sermon I get to preach to this group of people, what would it be? And I tried to take the easy way out, and I asked Thomas, have your leadership give me an assignment, and he didn't do that, and so I'm kind of frustrated with him about that. But initially I thought, well, I'm going to preach just something about the gospel of Jesus Christ, because truthfully I don't think that we in church circles have a real good definition of what that even means. So that was my initial thought. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, this is a really difficult time to be a Christian, I think. But, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's for the first time in the history of America, maybe it's easy to be a Christian. I'm not sure which. I know that you don't have to be a very astute observer of our culture to see that over the last 10 years, a lot has changed. There's an enormous amount of hostility toward your faith and toward my faith. I don't even have a clue how to predict what our young people are going to face in the next 20 years. I really fear what that's going to look like. And so, I think what I'm going to do this morning, if you'll permit, is spend a little bit of time just talking about what do we do with doubt. And I want to say, before I get going, that I think the first century church was probably a lot more about things like what Roger did up here than what I'm doing up here. It wasn't so much about the guest speaker coming from Rapid City, and more about family members sitting around together and encouraging one another and talking about their faith and strengthening one another. And I love that. We need more of the Roger segments and perhaps less of the preacher segments. I don't think there's anything wrong with preacher segments. You understand? But Roger prayed in his prayer that God help us with our unbelief. And it dawned on me, you guys are passing around a prayer list, and I listened to your prayer list, and your prayer list isn't unlike anybody else's prayer list. That's a double negative. Your prayer list is exactly like everybody else's prayer list across the country. It goes like this. Uncle Bob has got gout. My Aunt Nellie is going to have surgery. The next door neighbor's got problems with their marriage. But rarely on our prayer list does anybody say, I need help with my unbelief. And there's a reason for that. Because we've kind of strung up a false idea that in order to be a part of this group, in order to fit in with this group, you've got to be a guy who glows in the dark and gets up in the morning and hovers while he reads the Psalms, that kind of thing. You've got to be this epic individual of momentous faith in order to fit in with this group. Because we all are, boy, we're pretty strong people when it comes to faith. By the way, I've done this type of lesson in other places, and almost universally I get two responses. The response that I most appreciate is the one where somebody grabs me quietly and says, I'm sure glad you did this. But I also get a rather knee-jerk kind of response from the people in the room who feel like there's no way that they're ever going to struggle with faith. In fact, a few months ago, I was doing a segment somewhat like this, and I had a guy who was a visitor in the auditorium, and he spoke up in the middle of my sermon and literally took over. I had to terminate the services 10 minutes early because this guy would not sit down and hush. He was so mad that I was implying that Christians on occasion struggle with their faith. Well, I'm going to tell you two things. If you're one of those people who don't struggle with your faith, I'm going to say, first of all, I got nothing for you. Because my message has always been to the people like me who struggle, who fight, sometimes who go for weeks and then look themselves in the mirror and say, what is wrong with you? I mean, that's this guy. And my second thing I'm going to say to the people who don't struggle with their faith is, I'm going to quote Yoda. You remember when, can I do that? Is that okay? I'm asking the elder here. When Luke said, I'm not afraid, and Yoda said, you will be. You remember that? I can't do the Yoda voice. That's about all that qualifies a guy anymore to be a youth minister, but I don't do Yoda. So, what do we do with doubt? We live in a world where Bill Nye, the science guy, literally said a few years ago that it's tantamount to child abuse if you teach your children faith in God. And instead of being chastised by the leadership, he just advanced his station in our culture, tenfold. We are under attack on every front. Our kids are just getting killed out there. And they need to know, and those of you who are young people in the room, you need to hear this. God's people, Old Testament and New Testament, they have all wrestled at times with faith. They've struggled. They've put their fist in God's face and said, "What are you doing? What is wrong with you?" Jeremiah in the book of Lamentations. I love Jeremiah. I mean, his statement to God, "Are you going to be a deceitful brook?" You know what that is? A deceitful brook? The ranchers know what a deceitful brook is. It's one that's there in the fall, but in the summer, when you're driving the sheep or the cattle, and you say, "You know what? There was a little stream of water over that hill. When we get over there, we'll water the flock." And you get there, and it ain't there anymore. So Jeremiah, with his fist in God's face, looking across the landscape, and as far as the eye could see, hundreds of his nation's cities smoldering, burning. A carpet of corpses as far as the eye could see. "God, what are you doing? Are you going to be a deceitful brook?" Abraham, Peter, Asaph in Psalm 73 and 74. I mean, Asaph was a downer. If you read the Psalms that Asaph wrote, they're all, not all of them, but you know, Asaph says, "You know, I know God's good to Israel, but I was really struggling." I love that. That's John Dennis's paraphrase, by the way. I love the fact that Jeremiah resolves his conflict, by the way. He's the one who says, "Are you going to be a deceitful brook?" He's also the one who wrote a song we sing on occasion. "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases." Now see, that I can sink my teeth into that, because that is real biblical faith. It's faith that says sometimes, "God, I don't get you." Or, you know, "Is there even a God?" The prayer that Roger prayed this morning. Out of Mark 9, by the way. In Mark 9, Jesus dealing with a man whose son had been the puppet of a demon for a long time. And finally, Jesus says, well, the guy says to Jesus, "If you can do anything, please help us." Mark 9, if you're taking notes. And Jesus says, "If you can, all things are possible for those who believe." And the guy says, "Oh, I do believe. Help my unbelief." What? Make up your mind, knucklehead. Are you a believer or are you not a believer? That is biblical faith. It's Shadrach, Meshach, my dad used to say, and to bed we go. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who, as they are defying the king, and the king says, "What God is there who's going to save you from the fiery furnace?" And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "Oh, our God's able, but whether he will or not, we don't know." That's biblical faith. But probably no place better than Luke chapter 7. So I'd like for you to turn with me in your Bibles. that you brought to church. Before we do this, though, I'm just going to read a couple of passages out of Isaiah to set the stage. So, listen to these messianic statements. This one out of Isaiah 35. Let's see if I can find my spot. Verse 5, talking about this period of time when the Messiah is reigning. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. Burning sand will become a pool, etc. Okay, so I'm setting the stage, because it's going to play an important part in what we're going to read here in just a minute. Turn, if you're reading with me, turn over to Psalm 61. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach the good news. What's this? To preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners. That's, I think, probably the word blind there. Your footnote will probably say that. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So here's what Isaiah says about the coming Messiah. When the Messiah gets here, the desert's going to turn into an oasis. The lame people are going to walk. The blind people are going to see. The prisoners are going to be set free. Okay, so that's Isaiah and his picture of what's going to happen when the Messiah gets here. All right, so everybody in here, for the most part, knows who John the Baptist was. He was chosen, handpicked by God. He was one of those people who had the audacity to get involved in politics. Oops, I should have probably not said that. I'm kidding. He had the audacity to stand up to the king and to say, "What you are doing is not okay." And the king did what most politicians do when somebody challenges their authority. He tries to shut him up. And so he grabbed John the Baptist and he put him, we think, we don't know for sure where, but if you have the time and you're on the web, just Google Macarius. It's the name of the king's wilderness fortress, and it looks kind of like Bear Butte, except it's a lot bigger. And on the top of this butte, out in the middle of nowhere, there is this big fortress, and burrowed into the side of the butte is these cisterns that were dug to catch rainwater. We're pretty sure in one of those cisterns he imprisoned John. And John waited. And every time his disciples came and reported to him what Jesus is doing, that you have to kind of piece this together from other passages in the Gospels, but it appears that John would send his disciples out and say, "Find out what Jesus is doing." And they would go and they would come back and they would say, "Well, he just asked Matthew the tax collector to become a disciple." What? Yeah. And then he had a big party. In fact, that's about all the guy's doing these days. Just going from one party to the next. Well, what about me? You know, John, we were talking about this some in our Bible class this morning, Alan. Thank you for that. We were talking about the issue of being concerned about our own well-being. There's nothing wrong with that. You understand? The Scriptures don't ever say don't look out for your own interests. In fact, it assumes you're going to. John's looking out for his own interest here, and he's saying, why isn't Jesus doing something? And finally, verse 18, Luke chapter 7, John's disciples told him all these things, and calling two of them, he sent them to the Lord to ask, what? He sent them to the Christ, to the Messiah, to the Word in flesh. He sent them to Jesus to ask, are you the one, or are we looking for somebody else? Now, I have read a zillion commentaries on this, and almost every one of them said, well, this is all metaphorical, or it's, you know, it's, this isn't really a dark night of the soul, or blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you something. This is a dark night of the soul. John is on the rocks. He's on the ropes. He is out of faith. He has done everything exactly the way he thought God would have wanted him to do it, and now he's in prison for it, and he expected at some point for the Messiah to step in and intervene. And not only is the Messiah not stepping in and intervening, he doesn't even seem to care. Does that sound like any situation you've ever been in? Where your sweetheart was threatening to leave, or you were in a soul-sucking job and you're asking God, please, you know, save me from this, or no job at all, or a illness, or whatever, and you're saying, come on, God, I mean, I believe that you have the ability to do this. I've been trying to do things right. Why won't you step in and intervene? And it just echoes, and then there's crickets. When the men, verse 20, came to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist sent us to ask, are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else? And Jesus said, don't you remember? I was the one he baptized, and he saw... No, that's not what he said. At that very time, Jesus... I love this. This is... very likely my favorite piece of scripture in the entire New Testament. At that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, gave sight to many who were blind. So he replied to the messengers. Now, by the way, I want to say this just for those in the room who might be skeptics. The Bible is so not condemning toward people who are skeptics. The person in Mark 9 who says, help my unbelief, is in the same boat that this guy's in. And instead of Jesus saying, well, if you don't have faith, I'm not going to heal your kid. What does he do? He just gives the guy the evidence he needs to believe. Okay, so those of you who may be skeptics, and I don't know, I mean, most of you I know, most of us have history. I mean, lots of it. Thank God. But if you're a skeptic, I want you to know that the entire Bible is written around the idea of providing you with evidence that you need to believe. And in the meantime, in the time that it takes you to get from where you are to faith, it is so unbelievably gracious. God help us, Christians, to be that way too, right? So he replied to the messengers, verse 22, go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight. Does this sound like anything we just read? The blind receive sight, the lame walk, Those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. That's right out of Isaiah. You know the one he didn't mention? Captives set free. Ah. He didn't mention that the captives are set free. What do you think John's going to think when he hears this? Well, the important thing is that this wasn't really written for John. It was written for me and for you. After John's messengers left, Jesus began to speak to the crowd about John. What did you go out into the desert to see? A reed swayed by the wind? You just going out to see the scenery? If not, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in fine clothes? No, those who wear expensive clothes and indulge in luxury are in palaces. What did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, sir. I tell you, and more than a prophet, this is the one about whom it was written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. I tell you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John. What in the world are you saying? This guy is absolutely on the rocks and doubting that Jesus is the Christ, and Jesus is standing there saying, nobody greater than this guy. Well, fiddly D. Friedrich Nietzsche, German philosopher in the 1800s. Very likely is the one who coined the phrase, God is dead. He was quite renowned for his anti-Christian tirades. He would say, hope is the worst of all evils, for it prolongs the torment of men. I'd like to buy a ticket to hear that guy. He said, after coming in contact with a religious man, I always feel like I must wash my hands. He said, Christians can't be strong, so they make... Ooh, now here we go. Christians can't be strong, so they make a virtue out of weakness. I got news for you. Christians are strong. In fact, I'm going to take a break. I got kind of emotional with all of the hometown crowd here, so while I was up here, I kept looking around for a Kleenex box, and then I saw Salvation across the room there. For 2,000 years, under unbelievable opposition, God's people have stood, and they have refused to bow the knee, and it is awesome to behold. But it hasn't been easy, and it has always come with a price. So when your faith starts to come unraveled, just be aware of the fact that you're in good company. Almost every one of God's heroes, both Old Testament and New Testament, had their moments when their faith failed, when they went through that dark night of the soul, when they encountered enormous difficulty and their knees buckled. Paul himself, we were talking about Paul this morning. At one point, Paul just said, I couldn't even preach. You're in good company if you're struggling with your faith. You remember the Disney movie, The Song of the South, Uncle Remus? I know some of you younger people won't remember that, but I remember going to see that movie. I remember Zippity-Doo-Dah, Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. You know, some days are like that. I think we Christians think that that's kind of God's obligation to us, that every day be a Zippity-Doo-Dah day. The truth of the matter is, He didn't call you to Zippity-Doo-Dah days. If you have them, that's okay. That's called, let's see, what do we call that? Oh yeah, grace. But that's not what you were called to. That's not what you were designed for. Another story out of Song of the South, and I'll be done. You remember Briar Rabbit and Briar Fox, Briar Wolf? Well, Briar Fox had caught Briar Rabbit, and he was going to bile him up in a stew. You guys remember that? I can't do the Uncle Remus thing very well either, but I should probably work on my Yoda and my Uncle Remus. But he was gonna boil Briar Rabbit up in a stew, and Briar Rabbit started saying, no, please, whatever you do. Yeah, there you go. See, some of you are right there with me. He said, you can boil me up in that stew if you want to, but whatever you do, don't throw me in that briar patch. And then the camera pans to the briar patch. There's all these sharp thorns and thistles, and it was just, you know, and the music's on the lower register of the keyboard. And Briar Fox says, you know what? That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw you in the briar patch. And he, now I know this in good English, but bear with me. He flung him into the briar patch. And then you hear this, oh, woo. And then you hear this song coming from inside the briar patch. I was, what? Help me out. I was born and bred in the briar patch. You know what? Christianity was born and bred in the briar patch. We were designed in the very DNA. In fact, our King wears the briar patch on his brow. We were born and bred for the briar patch. And there's going to be doubt and there's going to be dark days, but God's people stand. And you know why we stand? We stand because we have family. Because we gather together. Some people think this is the goofiest thing on the planet. We get together and sing songs and pray prayers and break little pieces of cracker off. And that's why God's people stand. So thankful to have the opportunity to be with you. Stand.